Israel and the Middle East, The Last 6,000 Years, Part 2, was presented by Earl Craig on January 23, 2011, at Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2011. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
So here we are, part two, from the birth of Jesus Christ to the present, from the Romans to the Israelites. Before we do all of part two, let me give you a summary. There's a lot that's going to be going on here. And this will feel closer to home for us, more contemporary, because we are definitely still feeling the effects of a lot of what happens here in part two. So first of all, we have the fact that the Romans expelled the Jews from Israel in AD 130. And I mean pretty much all the Jews were gone from Israel, AD 135. The Muslim Arabs and then the Turks conquered, populated, and ruled over the area from 630 to 1917. That's a fairly long period of time right there. Then the European Christian Crusaders somewhat controlled Israel for an interval of less than 200 years from 1099 to 1291. Jews began large-scale immigrations to Israel in the late 1800s only. All right, from 135 all the way to the late 1800s, hardly any immigration by Jews into the land of Israel. It took that long for that to occur, with the rise of political Zionism. The British ruled over the area for 30 years from 1918 to 1948. We're going to see that they just basically threw up their hands after 30 years and said, "The problems here are insoluble. We don't want to have anything to do with the problems here anymore." And then the Israelis had ruled over the state of Israel since 1948 with often great opposition from the surrounding Arab countries. Oh, go figure. That surprise, surprise. And quite a few different times when that took place. So that's what we're going to be covering here. Palestine, Israel during the Roman period. Beginning of Christianity through Jesus of Nazareth and its spread by his apostles and subsequent believers. Christianity's messianic expectations. I just threw this passage from Revelation 19 in here, and I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it is called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he judges and wages war. His eyes are a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems, and he has a name written on him, which no one knows except himself. And he is clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following him on white horses. And from his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may strike down the nations. And he will rule them with a rod of iron. And he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God the Almighty. And on his robe and on his thigh he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Important aspects of Christian messianic expectations. Jesus of Nazareth will return as the Messiah, the Christ, the Anointed One. All those words mean the same thing. He'll be the conqueror of his enemies. He'll be a ruler over his people, both believing Jews and believing Gentiles, and the earth for that matter. But we have also this issue of the new heavens and the new earth, and we won't work that out theologically or biblically right now, but I'm sure you're aware of that in the New Testament, and even the end of Isaiah. King of the eternal kingdom of God, where his people will dwell. So these are important aspects. Christian expansion up to AD 30 in the Roman Empire. Green core areas of Christianity, 3rd century AD. A little bit of that'd be this area here, that area there, dark green there. The lighter green areas, the extent of Christian influence into the 2nd century AD. So we can see that by the 2nd century AD, most of the Roman Empire, the map that we looked at earlier, has been heavily influenced by Christianity. The black line here is the territory under control of the Roman Empire, and under Roman control. Moving on, with regard to the Palestine area during the Roman period, birth of Jesus Christ, AD 313, two revolts in Israel by the Jews against the Romans. The first one in AD 70, where the temple was Jerusalem was destroyed. The temple was destroyed. This is the second temple, kind of the third, really, but second temple by the Roman general Titus that was destroyed. AD 132, the effects that lasted for 1,700 years. Let's talk a little bit more in more detail about that second revolt, the Jewish revolt against the Romans in AD 132. It was the Bar Kokhba revolt, led by Simon Bar Kokhba. Bar Kokhba is an Aramaic word meaning star. So Simon, son of the star, he was a star. Emperor Hadrian summoned his general Sextus Severus from Britain all that way, and his troops were brought from as far away as the Danube River in Germany. He was going to settle the Jewish question once and for all. 580,000 Jews were killed. That's a lot in those days. You know, it'd be a lot in any day. That was a huge amount in those days. The remaining Jews were either exiled or sold into slavery. 50 fortified towns and 985 villages were razed by the Romans. Hadrian renamed the area Palestina as an insulting reminder of the Jews' ancient enemies, the Philistines. And that name remains to today. Long-term consequences of the Jewish revolt after their destruction and expulsion in AD 135, 132, whatever, that time period. Jewish communities continued to exist in Galilee. The priests were replaced by rabbis as leaders. The temple was replaced by synagogues as the focus of Jewish worship. There was the formation of the Talmud, from the Hebrew word lamad, to learn, a record of rabbinic discussions of Jewish law, ethics, customs, and history, the oral law, that expands upon the written law, the actual Hebrew scriptures themselves. The Jewish religious center shifted to Babylon for a long time, and to those who were descendants of the Babylonian exile in 586 BC when that occurred. Messianic hopes became mostly abstract and spiritualized. The Jewish connection with the land of Israel remained mostly abstract for the next 1,700 years until the rise of the Zionist movement in the 1800s. Small groups of Jews did intermittently return to Palestine over the next 1,700 years, but only small groups. Here's the Roman Empire around AD 17, about the same as the first map that we had seen of the Roman Empire under Augustus Caesar, except Britannia has been added. And maybe a little bit extra over here, but about the same size. Byzantine Empire, AD 313 to 630. The Roman Emperor Constantine converted to Christianity around that time. He moved the capital of the Roman Empire to Byzantium in 330 and renamed it Constantinople, which is modern-day Istanbul. Rome was sacked in 410 by the Visigoths, weakening the empire in the west. Here is the Byzantine Empire in red then, so you can see the west, this is AD 500, by the way, so this would be after the sack of Rome. Okay, but the Byzantines still had a lot of control over Italy, it seems, but the rest of it remains pretty much the same, except maybe this area over here in modern-day Iraq, the Mesopotamian Valley, but Greece, Syria, Sicily, Egypt down here, Israel, this area right there, modern-day Turkey. Syria, Lebanon, Jordan would be over there. Palestine, Israel, during the Roman period of AD 13 to 630, became mainly a Christian area. Churches built in Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Galilee, monasteries established throughout the land. Jewish rites were heavily restricted. The Sassanids, though Persians, invaded the land and restored Jewish rites in 614. Remember, the Sassanids' religion was Zoroastrianism. The Byzantine army recaptured Jerusalem and expelled all the Jews in 629. The Jews just they couldn't catch a break during a lot of this, most of this time, this era. Now we move on to the Muslim-Christian period of 630 to 1917, long period of time here. Ever-widening circle of influence. We're going to be talking about the Arabian Peninsula, that third from the bottom, Asia, the Turks and Mongols, as well as Europe from 1099 to the present. The Arabian Peninsula, Asia, Europe, and Egypt. A few words about each one of those. Oh, I guess that's all I want to say about those. So, well, rule over Palestine, Israel during the Muslim Christian period. Arab Turkish rule from 636 to 1099, mainly Muslim, therefore. Crusader rule, 1099 to 1291. Christian rule. Egyptian Mamluk rule, 1291 to 1516, Muslims. And then the Turkish Ottoman Empire from 1517 to 1917, also Muslim rule. Arabian Peninsula, Saudi Arabia. Arabia was sparsely populated by various Arabic-speaking people, Semitic peoples, who were mostly polytheistic. But then the rise and spread of Islam. Five things I want to go over, some in relatively detail. Regarding the rise and spread of Islam, we've got Muhammad, Islam's beliefs, Muhammad's successors, two sects of Islam, Sunni and Shia, and then the spread of Islam. So tackle number one, Muhammad himself. Lived approximately 570 to 632, born in Mecca on the Arabian Peninsula, founded the religion of Islam about 610, moved to Medina, a little bit farther inland around in north, around 622, eventually united the entire Arabian Peninsula under Islam and started expansion into Egypt, Syria, and Iraq. So here is a map of the Arabian Peninsula. Mecca there, where he was born, eventually moved to Medina. This would be then the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, so to speak, that would include Yemen and Oman. There's Israel, Palestine up in that area.
Those are very holy cities for their religion.
They are, exactly.
And yeah. I think is it Medina the one? I don't even think outsiders are allowed in the town, are they?
Gosh, good question, Tom. I'm not sure
Medina,
about that.
Medina, you're not even allowed in there unless you're Islam.
Is that right? Okay.
Sure.
And then the annual trek to Mecca that occurs too, that every good Muslim is supposed to make at least once during his or her lifetime.
Can you define the difference to us between Shia and Sunni?
Definitely I'm going to do that. Yeah, that's to come. Good question. Yeah, we're on our way to that. Islam's beliefs. Islam, from the Arabic word meaning safety or peace. If you're familiar with the Hebrew word shalom, you'll notice the S-L-M of shalom is also in Islam, S-L-M. So as a noun, in Arabic, it means submission or surrender, but has that same origin as shalom. Muhammad, and therefore a Muslim, and the M in Semitic languages, if they want to turn a verb into a noun, they'll add an M sound or a T sound at the beginning of the word. So M is just a M sound before Islam, but you change the vowel then from an I to a U, and you've got Muslim. So a Muslim is someone who submits and surrenders himself to God under the religion of Islam. There you go. Muhammad was God's final prophet, as far as their belief is concerned. The Quran, or Koran, if you've seen it spelled K-O-R-A-N, I went ahead and spelled it kind of this way. It's somewhat of a transliteration that I think that I've seen in various literature of the Arabic word. The Quran, as scripture, was revealed to Muhammad through the angel Gabriel. Their belief also in the five pillars of Islam is the most fundamental aspects of the Quran. We'll see those in a moment. The Day of Judgment, where everyone's deeds will be judged and forgiveness provided if merited. Notice that word, merited. Okay, there's the fundamental difference between Christianity and all other religions. I would claim is that particular issue right there. Sharia, a well-trodden path as the body of Islamic law. That is, Sharia means well-trodden path as the body of Islamic law governing public and some private aspects of life. And then jihad. We'll look at some of those too. Those are their basic beliefs. Five pillars of Islam. Testimony of faith, the first one. The statement that there is no God but Allah and that Muhammad is his last messenger. Second pillar, ritual prayer. Five daily prayers, daybreak, noon, mid-afternoon, after sunset, and in the early part of the night. I'm trying to remember if you're going to hear the call to prayer. Yeah, you've got to. Somewhere, getting close to Bethlehem, you'll hear those. Third, the and when you're in Israel, I'm referring to, obviously. The third, obligatory almsgiving that is distributed to the poor. Fourth pillar, fasting during the month of Ramadan and the ninth month in the Islamic lunar calendar. And then the fifth pillar of Islam, the pilgrimage to Mecca, compulsory once in a lifetime during the month of Zulhijjah. Jihad means striving or struggle, in which all Muslims must take place that will eventually result in the reappearance of the 12th Imam, the Muhammad al-Mahdi, who will change the entire world into a perfect Islamic society alongside the Prophet Jesus before the Day of Judgment. So these are Islam's messianic expectations. Five kinds of jihad: of the heart, the inner struggle against evil; by the tongue, against evil through writing and speech; by the pen and knowledge, against evil through scholarly study of Islam; by the hand, against evil through moral actions and political activity; and by the sword, that one we're most familiar with probably, holy war against those opposed to Islam. But it's good to know, for you to recognize, that there are these five different kinds, beginning with the inward, moving towards the outward, and ultimately the most violent, by the sword, holy war against those opposed to Islam. And this, it's part of the, discussion amongst Muslims as to which one of these really is intended by the Quran, or ought to be most intended by the Quran.
What does the term imam mean?
Do I have it? Am I going to get there? Other definitions, yes. Thank you for asking that question. First of all, caliph, though, before we get to imam, successor to Muhammad, a representative. The caliphate is the government ruled by a caliph over the Islamic world under Islamic law, Sharia. We'll touch on that again in a minute. Imam is a leader. Sheikh, elder of a tribe, lord, revealed elder man, Islamic scholar. Mufti, an Islamic scholar who is an interpreter or expander of Sharia. It doesn't seem as though there's going to be... it almost sounds as though you got Imam, Sheikh, and Mufti, kind of like the scribes and Pharisees. Maybe not all that much difference between them sometimes, depending upon...
Sharia
is the Islamic law. Where is that critter? Sharia, as the body of Islamic law governing public and some private aspects of life. This is what you have. The state of Oklahoma has now passed a constitutional amendment where it is illegal for Sharia ever to exist in the state of Oklahoma, for example. Great Britain is wrestling with the issue of whether or not to allow Sharia in the areas that are predominantly Muslim, in various parts of London and other places of Great Britain. We will run into the same thing eventually.
It's pretty major.
It is very major.
Would that be like having a separate, if you're Muslim, having a separate law that governs you?
Correct.
Above, or
in addition to, or in replacement of the law of the land. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay. Yeah.
On to number three here of these things that I was going to talk about regarding the rise and spread of Islam. Number three, Muhammad's successors, the caliphs. The first one, and this will come into play with regard to the question of Shia and Sunni eventually. The first one, Abu Bakr, Muhammad's father-in-law, and then Umar, a friend of Muhammad, Uthman, the friend of Muhammad after that, and Ali, Muhammad's cousin and son-in-law, considered the first imam and the first legitimate caliph successor to Muhammad by the Shiites. There's one difference there, all right? They do not recognize the first three. The Shiites do not. They recognize only Ali. Number four, about the Islam, two sects of Islam, Sunni and Shia. The Sunni, from the Arabic word meaning tradition. So you kind of figure these guys would be the Pharisees, I guess, of sorts. The Sunnis believe that the primary sources of Islamic law are the Quran and the Sunnah, the tradition of the Prophet Muhammad. They are the largest sect, making up 85 to 90% of the Muslims, believe that all the first four successors to Muhammad were legitimate. The Shia, short for Shi'at Ali, meaning followers of Ali, the fourth successor to Muhammad, and therefore for them the first real imam. They believe the first three successors were usurpers. Believe that only specific persons, from Muhammad's family were the best source of knowledge about Islam. They make up 10 to 15% of Muslims. Believe there were 12 imams from Ali in 656 to 661 to Muhammad al-Mahdi, 868 to the present, in the sense that he was hidden by God and will reveal himself as their Messiah, their Mashiach, on the day of resurrection and judgment. That's part of their messianic expectations. Consider the imams to have been infallible, kind of like the Pope for the Roman Catholic Church. This map here, won't go over it in great detail, but you can see that the brown, okay, I don't, what is the brown? Where does that come up? I went over this and now I've forgotten. Rise, Alona. Well, I guess we won't worry about that. But Iran, for example, is mainly Shiite. Here, Iraq is mainly Sunni, and yet what the Ba'ath Party are Sunnis. No, Shiites? I'm getting it mixed up. Where I'm trying to head with this is that part of the conflict, remember decades ago, between Iraq and Iran had to do with the fact that they are of two different sects of Islam. That's the point there. So, but you can see that most of that area is Sunni with just a few Shiites.
So, Earl,
yes.
Two questions. With the Sunni and the Shiite, are they both equally susceptible to the radical fundamentalism that we experience? And that's one question. The second question, okay. As far as Europe and the United States, are we seeing that same breakup in percentages, 85 Sunni, 15 Shia?
Two great questions, and I'm afraid I don't know the answer to either one. Yeah, that'd be great to follow up on. Your assignment for next time. Okay,
I'll
find that out for us. Wonderful. Thank you. Good questions, though. Modern Middle East disputes. So you've got Iran here and the Iraqi Sunnis. Deep hatred. This is from the Wall Street Journal, by the way. You've got the Iraqi Sunnis and Israel, obviously ongoing enemies. You can go over this on your own a little bit more, but Turkey up here even, what do we have? Turkey deposed to, or opposed to Kurdish state, and then you got the Kurds. There's violence between the Iraqi Sunnis. It's a mess. What can you say? The Middle East is an absolute mess. Deep hatred, ongoing enemies, various hostilities, allows foreign fighters, opposition, mutual suspicion, hostility, etc., etc. Spread of Islam, number five here. By the Muslim Arab armies who moved north from the Arabian Peninsula beginning in the 7th century, first into Egypt, then west along the northern Africa, along northern Africa and into Spain, and into Palestine and Syria, then east into Persia, Iran, as far as Afghanistan and northern India, constituted the migration of Arabs from Arabia to all these lands. Otherwise, they would have stayed pretty much right there on the Arabian Peninsula and the Palestinian area. So here we have the spread of Islam, Islamic world in the red down here under Muhammad, 622 to 632, then territories added by the first four caliphs, that area right there, territory added by the Umayyad caliphs in the green, and then non-Islamic kingdoms to the north there. Well, that'd be the spread from 622 to 750. That happened relatively quickly, 100 or so, a little over 100 years. Spread of Islam, Muhammad, Arabian Peninsula, first four successors added Egypt, Syria, Persia, Armenia. Umayyad Caliph, as I showed you, added North Africa, Spain, and Pakistan. And they moved the capital to Damascus in modern-day Syria. And the Abbasid Caliphate from 758 to 1258 moved the capital to Baghdad, modern-day Iraq. Then the Caliphate eventually lost Spain and North Africa. I'm sorry? Okay, the capital of the...
the center of Islam?
Yeah, basically. There you go. The Caliphate.
Administrative
center of the caliphate. That's right. The Umayyads ruled from Damascus. The Abbasids ruled from Baghdad. And the Abbasid caliphate, it's this line here, all right, that up along here, this is how much they ruled. The Abbasid Caliphate prior to its fall by the Mongols in 1258. So a fairly extensive empire on their part. Asia, we've got the Seljuk Turks and the Mongols to deal with. The Seljuk Turks migrated from Central Asia north of the Caspian and Aral Seas around 1100 during the Abbasid Caliphate. They converted to Islam, conquered Jerusalem in 1071, settled in central Turkey, and later formed the Ottoman Empire with its capital at Istanbul. The Mongols migrated from northeastern Asia, north of the Gobi Desert, around 1250. Mongol Empire. So here is the what's it called? The Khanate of the Great Khan. Here's another Khanate there, too. So the Gobi Desert right here. So the Mongols coming from this area, the Turks from Central Asia, so more in this area. So the Turks first, heading this direction and settling in Turkey, the Mongols migrating west from just north of the Gobi Desert over towards the Caliphate. So they migrated from northeastern Asia, the Mongols did, around 1250, converted to Islam, brought an end to the Abbasid Caliphate when they sacked Baghdad in 1258. But they were defeated by the Muslim Mamluks. So we get another Muslim group here of Egypt and had no significant influence in the Middle East afterwards. They just kind of disappeared into the woodwork. Palestine, Israel, during the Arab Turkish rule, ruled by the Muslim caliphs from Damascus first, then Baghdad and Egypt, the Mamluks. The Dome of the Rock was built on this is what you'll see in Jerusalem on the site of the Jewish temple in 691. The site includes also the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which you'll probably go in besides. Then Jerusalem conquered by the Seljuk Turks, as I said, in 1071. That lasted only 28 years until the First Crusade in 1099.
So that's the Dome of the Rock was built. That's at the Temple Mount then?
That's, yes. Yes, sir. That building right there that you see in the picture, built 691. Been there a long time. And a major place of worship for the Muslims. This, I think, is looking kind of more north. The Al-Aqsa Mosque, I believe, is going to be more over this area. The Dome of the Rock. West Wall and the Dome of the Rock. The Wailing Wall down here, which you all talked about last Wednesday night with David Crabtree. And, wow, big fence there. I got a lot closer than that. I don't know what was going on when this picture was taken. This is the walkway that you will take up to the Temple Mount when you go up there, where Jews are not allowed. Because the Temple Mount is administrated by Muslims, by the Muslim, what's it called? Waqfa, I think is what it is, a Muslim trust. So Jews are not actually allowed up there, and that's what was the problem when Ariel Sharon did go up onto the Temple Mount in September of 2000 that began the Second Intifada. That was right after my son Brad and I were in Israel and Jerusalem there in August.
By going through some kind of secret passageway or tunnel or something?
I don't think so. I think he walked right up this walkway. And next thing he knew, he had a war on his hands.
Yeah.
Civil war.
So how do they know? I mean, you just say they won't, Jews aren't allowed in. Do you wear something? What tells them you're a Jew and you're not?
Gosh, good question. I'm not sure. What would you ask them?
You just...
I'd like to know the answer to that. Yeah, find out about that. That's a great question.
I don't know. Yeah. Their skin is all the same. Hmm. I don't know.
Yeah.
I've often wondered that. How they say Jews aren't allowed. Mm-hmm. Is there, they don't have the star
from Germany. That's true. Yeah, good point.
Well, David was saying the Jews don't even want them either because they don't know exactly where the Holy of Holies was, and they might accidentally step on it.
Ah. Okay, so there's probably some sort of respect. And they know, too, that if they were to go up and be found out, that it would just, as Ariel Sharon found out, it just would create havoc all over again for them, more than they already have, as if they want that. A couple interesting inscriptions on the Dome of the Rock put there by the Muslims. I thought that you might like to know about these. The Anointed One, Jesus, Son of Mary, because I revere Jesus, was only a messenger of God, and his word which he conveyed unto Mary, and a spirit from him. So believe in God and his messengers, and say, not three, cease, it is better for you. God is only one God. Far be it removed from his transcendent majesty that he should have a son. There is no God but God. He is one. He has no associate. Say, he is God, the one, God, the eternally besought of all. He begetteth not, nor was begotten. And there is none comparable unto him. Muhammad is the messenger of God, the blessing of God be on him. So direct statements against Christianity, and specifically the Trinity and Jesus' deity. Won't take that up in this group any farther than that. I heard Bernard Lewis, who is a world-renowned Jewish scholar and expert in Middle Eastern affairs, issues, heard him speak at Temple Bat Yam in Newport Beach back in November 2006, and he said a bunch of things that I thought also that you might kind of be interested to hear about. First of all, Muslims believe the Quran replaces the Bible because the Jews and Christians distorted the message of God and proved themselves unworthy of retaining the purity of the scriptures. But Abraham was the first Muslim. Both Christianity and Islam believe they are the recipients of God's final message and revelation. And there's a sense of triumphalism that comes out in both of these religions, that they are the only way to heaven. That is both Christianity and Islam. The Talmud of Judaism proclaims that every person who obeys his or her society's moral laws will be accepted by God. That's why there's not this same kind of triumphalism that you find in Christianity and Islam in Judaism. So Islam's real beef is with Christianity. And the conflict exists not only because of their differences, but also because of their similarities. Also from Bernard Lewis in November of 2006, in the 1990s, the Muslims attributed the downfall of the USSR to jihad. Osama bin Laden perceives the world as a conflict between the true religion Islam and a corrupted one, Christianity. And the defeat of the effeminate Americans will be relatively easy compared to the USSR. 9/11 began a new stage, attacks within the U.S. And Osama bin Laden views our recent elections, and this would have been back, you know, before even just the most recent one, so I probably should have changed a little bit, but just to let you know, as equally significant to the collapse of the USSR. So that we are on our way to becoming weaker and weaker, which will allow for the triumph of Islam and Sharia in the U.S. Keep that in mind. Europe, a lot to be said here. Try to keep all this straight. We've got the Crusades to cover, the Ottoman Empire, the 19th century movements, and World War I. How about the Crusades first, then, regarding Europe? As an outside influence, remember we're still kind of in that category here of this time period, the outside influence on Palestine and Israel. The Crusades, appealed by Pope Urban II in 1095 to recover the Holy Land from the Muslims. And First Crusade, Second, Third, right on through the Ninth, so you got 1095 through 1272. Focusing in, though, on Palestine, Israel during the Crusader rule of 1099 to 1291, the Crusaders captured Jerusalem and killed most of the city's non-Christian population. That would include Jews in 1099. Established the Latin kingdom of the Crusaders, which survived until 1291. However, even before that, Jerusalem was recaptured and held by the Muslim ruler Saladin, so that the Latin kingdom of the Crusaders kept getting smaller and smaller. The pilgrimages and more crusades by Christians from Europe afterwards, and final defeat of the Crusaders by the Mamluks, that'd be the Egyptian Muslims, from Egypt in 1291. What about Egypt as an outside influence? Well, you have the Mamluk Empire from 1250 to 1517. The Mamluks were slave soldiers of the Arabs based in Egypt. The Mamluk Empire, you kind of imagine them to be somewhat like the Spartans, you know, very warlike, very militaristic. And as I say here, slave soldiers. They defeated the Crusaders and took over control of the Palestine in 1291, defeated by the Ottoman Turks in 1517. Palestine during the Mamluk rule, a dark age of sorts, ports and roadways destroyed to prevent new Crusades from being successful. Cities and towns in Palestine declined, Jerusalem mostly abandoned. Poverty in both the Jewish and Arab communities, only about 1,000 Jewish families there in 1517 in Israel. Therefore, mostly Muslim Arabs, but some Christian Arabs also. So that's between 1291 and 517. Now, we've got Europe and the Ottoman Empire. It actually came into existence in 1299 once the Muslim Turks moved through Iraq and settled in Turkey, captured Constantinople, effectively ending the Byzantine Empire in May of 1453, and the Turks renamed it Istanbul. Ruled by sultans, sometimes calling themselves caliph as kind of the head of the Islamic world, invited Jews fleeing the Spanish Inquisition to immigrate, defeated the Egyptian Mamluks and took over the control of Palestine from 1517 to 1917. So for 400 years, the Ottomans ruled Palestine. Repulsed after the Battle of Vienna in 1683, that began the decline of this Muslim empire. And there you have a map of it. The Ottoman Empire in red there, 1399, expanded green, 1672, and then blue, the vassal states, also in 1672. Decline of the Ottoman Empire, they lost the green territory there, 1774 to 1830, lost the red territory, 1830 to 78, lost the purple territory down here, northern Africa, as well as Greece, and then the Ottoman Empire in 1914, the beginning of World War I, which it figures into because of it being allied with Germany, is just this portion right there. Yes?
Why did the Ottoman Empire invite Jews to immigrate?
Because for a while, and depending upon kind of how, what portion of the Muslim Islamic world you read about, the Muslims were more tolerant and welcoming to Jews than Christians were. And I think, did I even say that that was as, during the Spanish Inquisition?
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, it's an interesting fact of history that Muslims, maybe overall, have actually been more tolerant of Jews than Christians have at different periods of time.
When they're not after the same land.
Yeah, when they're on, exactly. Yeah, once 1948 came about, though, well, we got a problem here. And anti-Semitism as a label for describing anti-Jews has increased, definitely, in Muslim countries. Remember that the word Semitic technically includes Arabs. So the label anti-Semitism, the Jews have encouraged us to use that term to focus on just simply anti-Jewish, anti-Jews. But the Arabs could use it just as easily if they wanted to. To be against an Arab is to be anti-Semitic too, because they're descendants of Shem. Spread of Islam. Number five here, Wahhabism. Founded by Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab, who lived from 1703 to 1792, led an Islamic movement in Eastern Arabia to return Islam to its original principles, allied himself with the House of Saud, which culminated in the creation of modern Saudi Arabia in 1932. Here's a quote, I think, from one of their instruction books. The Day of Judgment will not arrive until Muslims fight Jews, and Muslims will kill Jews until the Jew hides behind a tree or a stone. This doesn't sound very tolerant of Jews, does it? So just as that's why I said, depends upon, you know, where and what time, etc. This is 1700s earlier on, perhaps they were more tolerant. Then the tree and the stone will say, O Muslim, O servant of God, this is a Jew behind me, come and kill him. Except one type of tree, which is a Jew tree. That will not say that. don't ask me what, you know, I don't have no idea what a Jew tree is. This is taught to 14-year-old boys in Saudi Arabia, and Osama bin Laden grew up in Saudi Arabia. With oil revenues, the Saudi Arabian government has spent millions, and that was my, I use that word millions and then question mark, my source online said millions, I suspect it's more than that, of dollars to spread Wahhabism by building of mosques and Quran schools around the world, including here in the United States. So this quote is being taught to young Arab Muslim or young Muslim boys here in the United States too. Islam by country. You've got a bastion of Shiites here, Iran and that area, as well as Iraq, and then all the rest of this, the light green, are Sunnis. Muslim distribution. Christianity versus Islam. Guess which is Islam and guess which is Christianity? So the red here, mostly Christian countries. The green, mostly Islamic Muslim countries. White, I guess, stands for atheism over there in China and Mongolia, that area. Europe, 19th century movements, another aspect of Europe that's important for understanding the influence on Palestine and Israel. European powers in America jockeyed for position in the Middle East during the 19th century. British, French, and American scholars launched studies in biblical archaeology. Britain, France, Russia, Austria, and U.S. opened consulates in Jerusalem, and there was also the rise of political Zionism. Regarding the rise of political Zionism, effort by the Jews to return to the land of Israel as an internationally recognized home for Jewish people. First Zionist writings were published in Yugoslavia in the 1840s. Large-scale immigration of Jews into Palestine in the late 1800s due to persecution in Eastern Europe and disillusionment in Western Europe. And so this would be large-scale immigration since 132-135 AD. First large-scale immigration up to that point, no large-scale immigration. First Zionist Congress in 1895, you recall, I'm referring to the Bar Kokhba revolt and the Romans dispersing and, well, kind of the genocide that took place in that area as well as dispersing the Jews. First Zionist Congress in 1897, Basel, Switzerland. First Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland. Promoted return of Jews to Palestine, included an area of internationally recognized Jewish homeland. Originally was to be under Ottoman, or how ironic, German rule. This was their suggestion. Founded the Zionist organization there, the First Zionist Congress. Europe, then, regarding World War I and its influence on Palestine. Germany, Austria-Hungary, Bulgaria, Ottoman Empire, allied against versus the Great Britain, France, U.S., Russia, and Italy. Great Britain and France hoped to divide the Ottoman Empire's holdings in the Middle East after the war. You got two things to take into account there, the Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916 and the Balfour Declaration. The Sykes-Picot Agreement. It was a secret understanding between Britain and France regarding the Middle East after World War I. France would acquire Lebanon, Syria, and portions of Turkey and northern Iraq. Great Britain would acquire Jordan and southern Iraq, with Palestine jointly overseen, pending consultations with other allied powers. Great Britain also promised Arab independence in the same areas for help against the Ottoman Turks, but never fulfilled their promise. So here we have Sykes-Picot Agreement. The blue zone here would be direct French control. The lighter blue, French influence. So this is going to be Turkey and northern Syria. French influence in Syria. British influence there, extending all the way over into Iraq. This would be Iraq too, the Zagros Mountains and the Mesopotamian Valley right here, right on down to where they empty into the Gulf of Suez. British influence, and then this is the Allied condominium, meaning the dominion with, that is, the British and the French would rule this area together of Palestine and Israel. Balfour Declaration in 1917, it was a memorandum from Lord Balfour, Foreign Secretary of the British government, to the prominent British Jew Lord Rothschild. A formal British declaration for support of a Jewish homeland in Palestine without violating the civil rights of the existing non-Jewish communities. That's been the bugaboo. How do you do that? How do you provide a permanent Jewish homeland in that area without violating the civil rights of the existing non-Jewish communities? That question is still trying to be answered today. The Ottoman Empire, or the Palestine during the Ottoman during Ottoman rule. So I guess we're going on to this next part where we're going to sort of focus on Palestine and Israel, starting with the Ottoman rule, 1517 and 1916. Slight increase in Jewish population over 300 years. First large-scale immigration from Russia in 1882 to 1903. There were 24,000 Jews and 380,000 Arabs in Palestine in 1880. Second large-scale immigration of Jews from Russia and Poland between 1904 and 1914, so that there were 85,000 Jews and 615,000 Arabs in Palestine in 1914. Jewish majority in Jerusalem, with Hebrew as the predominant language, by 1870. And British forces entered Jerusalem and ended the 400 years of Ottoman rule in December 1917. So just a map of World War I for you to look at some more in your leisure. The green here, Germany, Austria, Ottoman Empire. The Allied powers in the yellow there, France, Great Britain, including the U.S., neutral nations like Switzerland, smack dab there in the middle, and Allied powers, including Italy, I guess, in this point, too, between 1914 and 1918. On to the ninth division of history, the British period between 1918 and 1948. We're now going to include the United Nations in our ever-widening circle of influence. Three areas during the British rule: surrounding Arab countries, Great Britain, and the United Nations. Surrounding Arab countries. There were some efforts to live peacefully with the Jews in Palestine between 1918 and 1948. Some efforts to disrupt, though, Jewish immigration and the establishment of a Jewish homeland. Regarding Great Britain, you've got the British Mandate of 1920, British Divided the Mandate, 1922, the Peel Commission, British White Paper, and British Request to the United Nations when they finally threw up their hands and said, we give up, in 1947. So what about the British Mandate of 1920? Well, the League of Nations granted Great Britain a mandate to control Palestine and the Transjordan, that'd be the modern Jordan. This included provisions for Great Britain to help the Jews build a national homeland and set up self-governing institutions comprised of both Jews and Arabs. And then the British divided the mandate in 1922. So here in 1920 would be the British mandate. This, if you draw a line right down here, that would be modern Jordan, and then this would be modern Israel over here, Dead Sea there, and the Sea of Galilee up north, Jordan River flowing from north to south, and then that's what I just said, is here's the division of the British mandate. So modern-day Israel and modern-day Jordan right there, what was called Transjordan. Syria up north, a French mandate, Iraq over here to the east, Saudi Arabia to the south, and Egypt to the west, or southwest. British census in 1922, there were 590,000 Muslim Arabs, 71,000 Christian Arabs, 83,000 Jews. I one time asked a Christian Arab just a few years ago, let's see, what was my question to her? You know, here in largely evangelical America, you know, we talk about when we became a Christian. And so I asked this woman, this Christian Arab, you know, when did you become a Christian? She said, my ancestors babysat Jesus. So that's when, as far as she was concerned, that's when she became a Christian. There were 83,000 Jews in Palestine, Israel in 1922. During British rule, the setup of self-governing institutions failed, because Jews feared they would have an Arab majority. Look at the demographics there. Arabs did not want to include Jews. Arab oppression of the Jews and riots against the British in 1920, 21, and 1929, and Arab revolt in 1936. Important point. In the 1920s, Winston Churchill stated that the Jews should exercise the political power and control in Palestine, but also support the moral and material benefit of all Palestinians. A friend of mine, Don Wagner, wrote the book Anxious for Armageddon and was the head of an organization called Evangelicals for Middle East Understanding that I was a part of for a while, wrote this in his book, Anxious for Armageddon. This is the crux of the issue in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Because Churchill and the British government failed to see the consequences of these assumptions and their effect on the Palestinian majority. The Peel Commission in 1937, the British recommended dividing Palestine into two states, one Jewish, one Arab, with a voluntary transfer of populations. You recognize this is during conflicts and uprisings and attacks, etc. You know, well, let's just divide this place with a voluntary transfer of populations. Okay, think about that. Okay? Someone all of a sudden says to you, you know what, you've got to pick up roots and you're moving to Washington because we're transferring certain groups of people in Oregon to Washington and certain groups of people in Washington to Oregon, and you just simply have to move.
Busing.
Right, busing. Jews as a minority considered the plan. Arabs as a majority rejected the plan. White paper, Great British White Paper, 1939. Response to further unrest between Jews and Arabs was to limit Jewish immigration to Palestine to 15,000 persons per year for the next 5 years. British later requested in 1947 that the United States settle the so-called question of Palestine. Also from Bernard Lewis, when I heard him speak down in Newport Beach in November of 2006, the rise of anti-Semitism in Muslim lands. Starting in the 17th century, conditions for Jews deteriorated in the Muslim world as anti-Semitism was introduced by Christian missionaries. In 1940, now this is, you know, Bernard Lewis is a Jew, this is his perspective on it. You know, okay, perhaps even so. Who knows? But there was the Spanish Inquisition. There was a lot of anti-Semitism in Europe. Jews were considered less than second-class citizens. So it's not beyond reasonable consideration that this really was true. In 1940, after the collapse of the French government during World War II, the French colonies allied themselves with the Nazi-run Vichy government, with Germans coming into Syria and Iraq, thus increasing anti-Semitism there. Islamic view is that once land is under Islamic law, it should remain such forever and be regained if lost. Keep that in mind for us here in America. Okay, if Sharia ever is allowed to exist, then what we're basically saying to the Muslims is that land now belongs to the Muslims and Muslims only. And that's the struggle in Europe and Great Britain now.
And that's the insight that the Arizona people have seen.
Oklahomans, yes. Oklahomans have seen, exactly.
Yeah.
They want none of that. Correct. Also, United Nations. In November 1947, the General Assembly passed UN Resolution 181 to partition the land of Palestine, establishing two states, the Jewish state and the Arab state, establishing one international zone, Jerusalem, and to go in effect on May 14, 1948. So here is a map of the partition plan. The light blue here would be the Jewish state. The red would be the Arab state, including the Gaza Strip. And then down here on the border of Egypt, this would be the West Bank. And then up on the border of Lebanon for the Arab state, Jerusalem would constitute an international zone. That was the plan. Just after UN Resolution 181, there were 600,000 Jews and 1.2 million Arabs in Palestine. The Jews accepted and the Arabs rejected the resolution. The Mufti of Jerusalem began attacking Jewish settlements. There was a massacre of the Arab community Deir Yassin by the Jewish Irgun, one of their so-called terrorist organizations, of which Menachem Begin was the leader, one of the leaders of that organization, who later became prime minister of Israel. Arab Palestinians, especially professionals and the better educated, began leaving Palestine, and the British did little to stop the conflicts. 10th division of history. Last one here, State of Israel, 1948 to the present. Our ever-widening circle is now going to include the very last one at the bottom there, America from 1948 to the present. Let me talk about three areas of outside influence during this State of Israel, surrounding Arab countries, Europe, and America. Surrounding Arab countries, some efforts to live peacefully with the Jews in Israel, some efforts to eliminate the Jews in Israel. Europe and America. Economic involvement with both Arab countries and Israel that has affected their judgment of the situation, that is, Europe's and America's judgment of the situation in the Middle East. U.S. foreign aid to Israel as of 2006, $92 billion since 1949, $3 billion per year, $1.2 billion in economic aid, $1.8 billion in military aid. 30% of our total foreign aid budget goes to Israel. That small little area there, remember that. Recognition of the recent history of the Jews that has motivated them to support Israel. Europe, obviously, because of the Holocaust. America, same sort of thing. Palestine and Israel, since the establishment of the State of Israel, in 1948, 8 major military conflicts with either the Arab countries or the Palestinian Arabs. 13 attempts to establish peace between Israel and either the Arab countries or the Palestinian Arabs. Here are the 8 major conflicts. War of Independence in 1948, Suez Canal Crisis 56, Six-Day War 67, Yom Kippur War in 73, Israel's invasion of southern Lebanon in 82, First Intifada by the Palestinian Arabs in 87, Second Intifada, right after I was there in 2000, Israel-Gaza conflict and Israel-Hezbollah conflict in 2006.
What's Intifada?
Intifada means uprising, okay. I believe. 13 attempts at establishment of peace, all going all the way back to 1949. The armistice is signed with Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon, and then right on through to 2006 and Annapolis. And ongoing attempts, I guess, even now, you could call those. But no time when people really sat down and said, okay, let's see if we can iron out our differences. In the 40s, Jews proclaimed the State of Israel on May 14, 1948. Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq said, welcome to the hood. By invading Israel on May 15th, a day later, the War of Independence that lasted until March of 1949, with the IDF and the IAF being established during that time. Israel signed armistices with Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon, but not with Iraq. Beginning February 1949, the West Bank came under Jordanian rule, Gaza Strip came under Egyptian rule, and Jerusalem divided with Jordan's controlling the eastern part, including the Old City and the Temple Mount, and Israel's controlling the western part. So these are the armistice lines there, the blue basically being Israel, adding this portion here, and then the West Bank, Egypt here, Jordan controlling that, and Syria still having the Golan Heights, but only until 1967. Just a couple of comments about the Palestinian refugee problem, going back to a question earlier. The UN reported that between April 1948 and July 1949, approximately 760,000 Palestinians were forcibly expelled from their homes. And the Jews, Israel seized an additional 23% of the land designated for an eventual Arab state. Many more Palestinians fled of their own volition, either simply to escape the war there in 1948 or at the encouragement of the attacking Arab states, with the understanding that they could return after the Jews were eradicated. Israel refused to readmit more than a small number, maybe 100,000, of the refugees after they won the war. Up to the present day, the UN has registered more than 4 million Palestinian refugees worldwide. So the Palestinian refugee problem. Current Palestinian refugee counts are Jordan, you got 1.8 million, Gaza, 990,000, and right on down to Egypt that has 70,000. And they are literally concentrated in what are still called today pretty much refugee camps because of that issue I brought up earlier where these countries just don't, like Jordan, Syria, even Lebanon, Egypt, definitely. They don't want these folks assimilated into their culture. They want them left on the borders in their refugee camps. Back in 2000, Brad and I visited some Palestinian Arabs in their home down near the city of Hebron. And it was their third home. On the drive up to their home on the side of the hill, we passed their previous two homes that have both been bulldozed by the Israeli army, and had a nice visit with them. Hebron itself, a city down in southern Israel, there are 165,000 Palestinian Arabs living in Hebron. There are 500 Jews living in the very center of that city, partly for symbolic reasons. There are 1,000 Israeli soldiers that protect those 500 Israeli Jews from the 165,000 Palestinian Arabs. The mayor of Hebron has also invited the Christian organization, Christian Peacemakers Team, into Hebron, and they are there to try to help kind of keep peace between the two peoples. And we were, Brad and I were provided with a small tour of downtown Hebron by one of the gals there from CPT who was wearing her red armband to indicate that she was part of that team. But it's an interesting thing to talk to the people, both Jews and Palestinian Arabs. Right after we went from that home down near Hebron, visiting the Palestinian Arabs in their home, to the Dehesha refugee camp in Bethlehem, where we also met with some Palestinian Arabs, and they showed us the key. That it was the key to the front door of their home that they used to live in what is now Israel proper, but they were forcibly expelled from their home back in 1948, but they still had the key to their home and would love to return to that home. So it's a difficult situation there, no matter which side you're looking at it. Jewish refugee and immigration counts, by various accounts, approximately 800,000 Jews fled, were expelled or immigrated from Arab countries. Between 1945 and 1956, the immigration doubled the Jewish population in Israel to over 1.2 million from 1948 to 1952. In the 60s, the Arab League, meeting in Cairo under the leadership of President Nasser, founded the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, in 1964. The goal was to destroy the State of Israel and establish an independent Palestinian state. Syria began shelling Galilean communities from the Golan Heights in 1966, and the Six-Day War eventually ensued against Egypt, Syria, and Jordan between June 5th and the 10th in 1967. Six-Day War, Egyptian President Nasser moved troops into the Sinai Peninsula and blocked the Straits of Tehran down at the bottom of the Gulf of Aqaba. They're just at the northern portion of the Red Sea. Israel launched a preemptive strike, destroying 400 of Egypt's Air Force planes, basically saying, take that. Jordan and Syria attacked Israel. After the ceasefire, Israel took control of all of Jerusalem. Israel took control of the West Bank and the Golan Heights. And Israel regained control of the Gaza Strip and the Sinai Peninsula. This is just a map of the very lowest portion of the Gulf of Aqaba. This is the Gulf of Aqaba there. So Israel, Eilat is at the bottom of Israel. And what Nasser blocked was the Straits of Tehran, right there at the bottom of that gulf. Six-Day War, a map that shows you that. You got the Egyptians moving in here from the west, all Saudi Arabians, Jordanians, Syrians moving in from the east, and Lebanese moving in from the north. Ceasefire lines. After the war, Israel basically had control of this whole area, including this portion of the Golan Heights. If you go to Syria and you buy a map of Syria today, this portion is still included on that map as belonging to Syria. They want it back big time. In the 70s, the Yom Kippur War. In October 1973, the Egyptian army crossed the Suez Canal and the Syrian army invaded the Golan Heights, both crossing the ceasefire lines of the 1967 Six-Day War. Israel advanced to within 20 miles of the Syrian capital, Damascus, but then withdrew. Israel crossed the Suez Canal towards Cairo, but then withdrew, and that ceasefire after 20 days. So that just shows you the Yom Kippur ceasefire lines that extended here beyond the 67 lines. So a little bit of portion there and that portion there. In the 70s, the Yom Kippur War against Egypt and Syria. Oops, I already did that. Where did I? Oh, adding more to it. I'm sorry, down a little bit below. Egyptian President Anwar Sadat visited Jerusalem in 1977. Sadat and Israel Prime Minister Menachem Begin signed the Camp David agreements led by U.S. President Jimmy Carter in 1978. Israel returned the Sinai Peninsula to Egypt, and the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel in 1979 ended a 30-year state of war between the two countries. Just a picture of Begin on the left there, Sadat on the right, and Jimmy Carter in 1978. In the 80s, the Egyptian Islamic Jihad assassinated President Sadat in 1981. The IAF destroyed the Iraqi nuclear reactor in 1981, which they're considering doing again now. Probably even as we speak, plans are being made up, drawn up, and who knows what's going to happen there.
You're thinking about Iran now, aren't you?
Oh, I'm sorry, Iran. Very good. Yes, thanks, Tom. Not Iraq, the Iraqi nuclear reactor, but Iran now. Yeah, and doing the same kind
of
thing.
Not in March.
Not in March. I understand the plan will take place on the 1st of April. They'll put it into effect. That's right. Yeah. Israel invaded southern Lebanon to stop Palestinian refugee attacks in 1982, and Israel remained there, occupying southern Lebanon for 18 years. Many Palestinians fled southern Lebanon while Iran sent its revolutionary armies there. Okay, so this is how Iran does get involved and still is involved today. To organize a resistance movement, Hezbollah, Party of God, or Hezbollah, as we would spell it, in 1982, the Hezbollah has been there, therefore. Iran has had a presence in southern Lebanon since 1982, almost 30 years now. The first Intifada, revolt against Israel, began in the Gaza Strip and West Bank as Palestinians became increasingly frustrated with Israeli presence between 1987 and 1991. Sheikh Ahmad Yassin in the Gaza Strip founded Hamas in 1987, a Palestinian Sunni organization which refuses to recognize the state of Israel and now controls the Gaza Strip. In the 1990s, the Iraqi Scud missiles hit Israel during the Gulf War of 1991, the Oslo Peace Accords in 1993. Oslo Peace Accords in September of that year, signed by Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat, Israel recognized the PLO as the representative of the Palestinian people. That was huge, 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 huge. The PLO renounced terrorism and committed itself to amend its charter so as to recognize Israel and have as its goal a Palestinian state alongside Israel. Huge, huge, huge. Amending the charter, though, has never happened. That's what's huge also. I mean, it's one thing to say it. It's a whole other thing to put it in a writing. And they have just, and they have never gotten around. I checked even just yesterday to make sure I was still right about this. Went online. Nope, that charter, the PLO's charter, has never been amended to recognize the state of Israel. They still, the charter still reads, we are for the destruction of Israel. Establishment of the Palestinian Authority during the Oslo Peace Accords, which was to result and has resulted in transfer of powers and responsibilities in the West Bank from Israel to the Palestinian Authority starting in August 1994. Picture of Rabin, Clinton, and Arafat in Washington, D.C., September 13, 1933. Also in the 90s, let's go on then to the third item there. Israel continued building settlements on the West Bank and Gaza Strip, obviously a huge bone of contention still today. Israel and Jordan signed the Jordan-Israel Peace Treaty in 1994, ending a 46-year state of war between those two countries. Israeli-Palestinian Interim Agreement, 1995, to broaden Palestinian self-government in the West Bank. In the 2000s, Israel withdrew from southern Lebanon, Camp David Summit, Second Intifada after Ariel Sharon visited the Temple Mount, the Taba Summit, the Roadmap for Peace by U.S. President George W. Bush, anti-terrorist fence began, 7 years ago, 2003. You will definitely, I didn't see that. I was there in 2000. So that's something. I only seen pictures. Oh, I've got a picture at the end here. Hamas won a victory in Palestinian parliamentary elections in January 2006. The Israel-Gaza conflict in June-July 2006. Israel-Hezbollah conflict there also in 2006. Ceasefire on August 14th. The Fatah-Hamas conflict resulting in Hamas controlling the Gaza Strip and Fatah controlling the West Bank. So you've got kind of a split in the Palestinian-Arab. It's kind of maybe like the Republicans and Democrats, you know, here in the United States. Annapolis, that U.S. attempt to bring together Israelis and Palestinians after 7 years with Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and President Mahmoud Abbas pledging peace by the end of 2008. To that Camp David summit, Clinton, Arafat, and Ehud Barak, eventual proposals by Clinton. Palestinians would receive 97% of the West Bank. Refugees could return with Israeli consent. And the Arab neighborhoods and the Temple Mount would be incorporated into a Palestinian state. Taba summit, January 2001, in Egypt, if I remember correctly, to discuss Clinton's proposals. Israelis accepted them. PLO rejected them. The Saudi Arabian ambassador said, if Arafat does not accept what is available now, it won't be a tragedy. It will be a crime. Regional threats to Israel. From as far away as Iran, you've got missiles, Scud missiles from Iraq. We're familiar with that. Fighter planes from Saudi Arabia, Scud missiles from Lebanon, and then the Katusha and Qassam missiles. Do I talk about those? Yeah, next one, Qassam, Katusha. Katusha rocket threats to Israel from southern Lebanon as well as from the Gaza Strip. Here's a Katusha rocket launcher built in Russia. Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, thought I'd just throw a few things in here about him. Israel, quote-unquote, is an illegitimate regime. Also, although the main solution is the elimination of the Zionist regime, at this stage an immediate ceasefire must be implemented. That was back in August of 2006. How accommodating he was being then. Ahmadinejad's ultimate goal, though, is to trigger the reappearance of the 12th Imam, who will usher in a worldwide Islamic society. So what we have in Israel is the collision of the three messianic expectations of the religious Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims. Bernard Lewis said, the current Chamberlain-like appeasement of Iranian president is wrong because he is a very dangerous man for whom mutual assured destruction is not a deterrent against war, as with the U.S. versus USSR, but an inducement to war. Interesting comment by him. From the Jerusalem Post in February 07, Reza Zarabi. Iran is an ultra-nationalistic society, yet not necessarily religious. Iranians view their complete history, especially their pre-Islamic empire, with much adoration and respect. Islam to this day is viewed primarily by the youth as an outside element that really does not belong to them or their society. The reverence Iranians have toward Islam comes from the evolution that Islam undertook within Iran, hence the Shia and Sunni divide. Shia Islam is more or less the Persian version of Islam. The religious nature of the government is in no way representative of the population at large, and in many ways is at enmity against the population. The regime actively vilifies ancient Iranian heroes such as Cyrus the Great, Darius the Great, Babak, and Ferdowsi by denouncing them as illegitimate. Yet in classic Persian fashion, the more that true Iranian culture is suppressed by the regime, the more Iranians relate to their pre-Islamic past. Iran at its core, within one's home, is a very secular society. Once the regime falls, many Iranians feel that Islam might even disappear from public life, to be only practiced within the home and in places of worship. This is especially true in regards to Islam's future in the political arena. And Bernard Lewis said back in November of 06, the more anti-American a government is, like Iran, the more pro-American the populace. The more pro-American a government is, like Great Britain, the more anti-American the populace. There's a picture of the fence. There is a map of the location of the fence. So this being the West Bank of Israel there, and the Dead Sea, obviously, and Israel proper. Yes, that is a lot of fence, isn't it? I mean, that high, too.
How many miles is that?
Oh, good question. Not sure.
But I understand since they built it, the bombings and things like that, suicide bombings, have just...
Have you heard much in the news lately?
Yeah.
No. Yeah, that's true. I wanted to mention to you back up there, here this... all the statements about referring to the past, people attaching to the past, though. My fourth question was, how much does the past for a particular culture, especially there in the Middle East, play into their view of themselves and their foreign policy and what they're doing now? I read that Saddam Hussein began to build a palace for himself on the ruins of Babylon. Baghdad is on the, I think I mentioned this already, is on the banks of the Tigris River, so the more northern river. Babylon is on the Euphrates River, and he started building a palace for himself on the ruins of Babylon. And as the is either Darius or Cyrus, we found bricks from buildings that they built way back. My goodness, that'd be around 500 BC or so, where they put their name and maybe a little comment about them on bricks that were used to build buildings during their era. Saddam Hussein did the same thing. I think if I can remember the quote fairly accurately here, Saddam Hussein, son of Nebuchadnezzar, built this building for the glory of Iraq. So, kind of as he was thinking about that, and just shows you how much, even for people like Hussein, his past was influencing his own policy, his own desire, and egomaniacal desires, maniacal desires to restore the ancient Babylonian empire and have himself as the emperor of that. So that's what Israel's up against there in that area.